judge and judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. It's a pleasure for the clerk to be here this morning at the University of Virginia Law School. We're here as part of our Project Outreach program. And that program was started in 1987 to increase the exposure of the court and also to provide law students the opportunity to observe a federal appellate court in operation. Interestingly, the first argument that we held on the Project Outreach Program was here at the University of Virginia in 1987. Since that time, we've held 140 arguments in various law schools and military installations across the country, and two arguments on aircraft carriers underway at sea. This is the court's fourth visit to the University of Virginia, which I think makes it almost more than any other law school. We certainly appreciate the invitation and we enjoy coming down here. Our court is currently operating with a vacant seat. We have a nomination for that seat, but the confirmation by the Senate has not taken place yet. And when that happens, we fill the vacant seat with either our senior judges or an Article III judge that the Chief Justice designates for assignment to our court. We're fortunate today to have Senior Judge Royce Lambreth of the Federal District Court of the District of Columbia. Royce is the former Chief Judge of that court to join us today. And I also should note that Judge Olson is a graduate of the UNV School of Law, and this is somewhat of a homecoming for him. The order in which we'll hear the arguments today is the appellant will be first, then the amicus in support of the appellant, the government, and then the appellant's rebuttal. Counsel, are you ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. The court calls United States versus Rapper.
Chief Judge Erdman, judges of the court, may it please the court. My name is Catherine DePaul, and together with Captain Heather Tragel, we represent the appellant, Specialist Eric Roper. This is a case about statutory interpretation and freedom of speech, arising out of comments the appellant made to friends at an election night party. The court below erred for three reasons. First, in light of Alanis, the court erred in applying a negligence standard to Article 134 of the UCMJ for communicating with friend. Second, the court erred because Special Scraper's speech was constitutionally protected political hyperbole. And finally, the court erred because Special Scraper's speech did not amount to a threat under the totality of the circumstances, nor did it present a reasonably direct and palpable connection to the military mission or environment as required by Wilcox. Turning to the first error, the rule of law from Alanis is that absent clear statutory, clear legislative intent, courts will not read into a criminal statute a mens rea of negligence. Like the federal statute that the court looked at in Alanis, Article 134 of the UCMJ is a federal statute for communicating a threat that is silent on the mens rea with respect to the threatening language.
Counsel.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it's silent. It's also a different statute with different elements. The Supreme Court based Alanis totally on statutory construction. It's not a constitutional decision. Tell us how and why we should apply Alanis to a different statute with different elements, presumably enacted for a somewhat different purpose. And could you speak up, please?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Your Honor, first, the Alanis decision was issued by the Supreme Court. And second, as the Court noted, it was a decision based on statutory interpretation. Now, while there are some substantive differences between civilian law and military law, there is no legal reason why this Court would not apply a Supreme Court decision based on statutory interpretation to a military justice case.
But this is a 134 offense that was actually created by the President, and the President set forth the elements of that offense, and in the interpretation of those elements, specifically said that the individual need not intend to carry out the threat. And that appears to go to mens rea. And I it's not a direct comparison between the two statutes, but it does appear that the military statute is considerably different because there is a reference to intent.
Your Honor, in the Alanis, the Supreme Court never suggested that Alanis had to intend to carry out the underlying act, nor does appellant suggest that Article 134 of the UCMJ requires the government to prove that the accused intended to carry out the underlying threat. What the court in Alanis was concerned with was the fact that the statute allowed conviction without the government having to prove that the accused intended to communicate threatening language.
What do you think would need to be shown to meet the recklessness standard? I mean, you'd agree that a lot of us did not weigh in on the decision whether recklessness would be enough, right?
Correct, Your Honor, and I believe recklessness is just an ordinary application of the term in the law, that there was essentially an intentional disregard for a known risk that somebody would perceive the language as a threat.
So why wouldn't that standard be met here? How do we know what standard the CCA applied when it didn't write the paper?
Your Honor, we know that the court convicted Special Trooper on a negligence standard because under military law at the time that the case was tried, the law was very clear that the individual what the government was required to prove was a reasonable person would have understood the threat, understood the language to contain a threat.
I'm just saying they discount them proving something more. So, for example, if someone really meant it, right, they could still be convicted.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Or if someone was really reckless about how their speech would be perceived by others, they could still be convicted. The negligence was just the minimum thing that needed to be proven.
They could, Your Honor, although I would note in this case, in the government's closing argument, they specifically argue that the government did not have to prove that the special favor intended to communicate threatening language, that it was sufficient that a reasonable person would have understood his comments to be threatening. And so that was the evidence that was before the trial court, and that was what the special favor was convicted of.
So that was the theory under which the government proceeded and that he was convicted?
Yes, Your Honor. There was absolutely no evidence that special favor intended to communicate threatening language to the principal.
And your argument is that Alanis changed that. Is there any other argument as to why that language that the government used in argument is no longer valid?
Your Honor, in light of Alanis, the military law right now allows for an accused to be convicted for communicating what a reasonable person would understand to be a threat. There is no requirement that the court in Alanis was specifically addressing that the language be intended to communicate.
Then I think that gets back to Judge Stuckey's question as to why are we looking at a separate federal statute with different language and applying that to a 134 offense in the military.
And Your Honor, I would go back again, it's a Supreme Court decision based on statutory interpretation. There is no substantive legal basis for not applying that statutory interpretation to the military. I'd also like to note that recently the Joint Services Committee recommended amending the manual for courts martial, specifically Article 134 of the UCMJ for communicating threat, to define wrongfulness in light of Alanis. Specifically, the recommendation was that wrongfulness be defined as an individual intentionally communicating threatening language, communicating threatening language knowing that it would be understood to be a threat, was reckless with respect to whether the language would be threatening.
But doesn't that cut both ways? If they're recommending a change, it indicates that the statute is not what you're arguing that it is.
No, Your Honor, what the appellant is arguing is that the statute right now is flawed because there is no mens rea with respect to the threatening language. As the government argued in their brief, that the fact that the elements of wrongfulness and prejudice or discipline and service discrediting save this statute, that is not the case. Those two elements do not speak to the issue that concern the court of law.
Well, the statute's not flawed. You're saying the manual's flawed.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Because it's the explanation.
Right, the explanation. Right.
Yeah. Yes, Your Honor.
I think the point that you're trying to make is that the terminal element does not self-supply the mens rea.
Correct. Yes,
and that Alanis was concerned with the absence of the need to prove the mens rea with respect to this a very similar sort of statute.
Yes, ma'am. Specifically, the court said that what made the language in Alanis criminal was its threatening nature. And therefore, the mental state had to apply to the fact that the communication contained a threat. Under the military right now, there is no such requirement. So an individual can be convicted for communicating speech that, yes, is wrongful, and yes, is prejudicial to voter and discipline and service discrediting without any proof that that individual intended to communicate a threat.
Can you go back and answer my question as to why this language wouldn't be the reckless standard? Why the facts and circumstances of the language used in this case wouldn't mean recklessness.
Yes, Your Honor. I think you have to look at the circumstances under which this speech was uttered. First, the communication took place at home, specifically a friend's house on the back porch. It was in the midst of a presidential election. Special Treasurer was concerned that President Obama was signed into legislation, law preventing him from owning assault rifles. No reasonable person would have taken his comments to be a threat.
But under the facts and circumstances of this case, where at least one of the individuals that was present there listening to this language had been told previously by the appellant about a lynching done by the family, told about all the weapons that he had in Missouri, and knew how angry he was, why wasn't he at least reckless as to how his language would be perceived, and in fact, the person that heard the language did perceive it that way.
Your Honor, I think we have to look at what Special Treasurer said. To believe what he said to be an actual threat, Mr. Kilburn would have had to have thought that Special Treasurer had the Missouri KKK just under his thumb and at his direction, that he'll come to Washington, D.C. and kill the president. It's practically absurd on its face, and Mr. Kilburn actually acknowledged during his testimony that there wasn't anything specifically about what Special Treasurer said that night or any prior night that made him think this was a serious threat. He said that he takes everybody at their word because of what happened at Columbine. And so.
And what's wrong with that?
Well, Your Honor, we have at least the...
When you're talking about a weapons threat, a threat involving a threat of death, I think there are people that who would say that you should be taking those seriously, particularly under the circumstances that we have in this case.
Your Honor, we can't divorce what was said from the facts and circumstances. And so when it's spoken in the context of what it is, Mr. Kilborn's statement that he takes everybody at their word is directly contradictory to the court's First Amendment jurisprudence. We don't allow for somebody to just say, well, just because you said it, then it's reasonable. You have to look at the facts and circumstances.
So Mr. Kilburn was not reasonable. How about the Secret Service when they decided that they were going to take the threat seriously?
Your Honor, the Secret Service agent, that is their job, is to prosecute threats against the president. The Secret Service agent specifically acknowledged that they take all threats seriously.
But he also said that they don't follow up on the vast majority of them.
He did, Your Honor, and I'd ask the court to consider the reasons why the Secret Service followed up in this case. Number one was that the soldier has weapons. Well, that's true of many people. And the fact that he has weapons actually lends credence to the convictions with which he holds his Second Amendment right. Day and New Year's when everybody would have. There was absolutely no evidence that Special Draper was part of the KKK or that he had any actual intention of harming the president.
Counsel, you referred to the circumstances. And one of the things you cited in your favor as being the fact that the accused was talking about this in the context of the Second Amendment and his concern about what the president might do. Doesn't that perhaps cut the other way in terms of your argument when there's such a visceral reaction within the nation about Second Amendment rights, that if the appellant was making those threats against the president in that context, then in fact it added an air of legitimacy to
it? No, Your Honor, I think the court has to leave room for constitutionally protected political hyperbole. The Supreme Court in Watts recognized that political hyperbole is protected under the First Amendment, and this court in Johnson has recognized that political hyperbole applies to the military. So while, yes, his comments were outrageous and over the top, but that's exactly the purpose of hyperbole, is to exaggerate for effect. The reason he was using this language is to communicate to his friends how strongly he believes about the Second Amendment and how disappointed he was that President Obama was reelected.
Is there a limit to political hyperbole in the military?
Your Honor, the issue is that at what point does political hyperbole stop and does in this case, does an actual threat begin?
So what language do you think would need to be added to the words that you used to change it from pure political hyperbole to a true threat?
Your Honor, I don't think it's necessarily the words that were used in this issue. It's the circumstances in which they were uttered.
So these same words were uttered in a different context. Do you think that would change everything?
It certainly could, Your Honor. The facts and circumstances are very important in this case. Unlike the seminal free speech cases, Parker and Priest, where the speakers were either verbally or through the distribution of literature, actively encouraging soldiers not to go to war, namely Vietnam, or in the case of Priest, informing soldiers where in Canada they go to desert. This case differs in form, and substance. This speech took place at a private residence at a friend's house on the back porch where everybody's smoking following a gathering intended to spark discussion about politics. They were watching the election results. And so for those reasons, this speech differs markedly from the other speeches that is considered dangerous in the military context. And if there are no further questions about Alanis or the constitutional right of Special Draper to speak political hyperbole, I'm going to turn to the third area, and that is that this speech did not amount to a threat under the totality of the circumstances, nor did it present a reasonably threatened probable connection to the military mission or environment as required by Rule Counts.
Counsel, in that regard, in your brief, you refer to the fact that the first statements that were made by Kilburn in his testimony, it was essentially conditional language, could be viewed that way. But then, when it was essentially a leading question by counsel, the condition melted away. There was no objection to that leading statement, leading question. And aren't we to look at the record in the light most favorable to the government?
Yes, Your Honor. But I think the court can consider the fact that Mr. Kilburn originally testified that Special Draper said he might go back to
the jury. The language in the specification that he was convicted of. The language that he was convicted of that's in the specification contains no condition.
That's correct, Your Honor. And what appellant would submit is that...
So that's, you'd agree that that's what they convicted him of?
That's what they convicted him of. Yes, Your Honor. And so under the totality of the circumstances, for the reasons previously discussed, that this was speech wrapped up with ideas about the Second Amendment and President Obama's fitness to be commander-in-chief, this is not, and the fact that Mr. Kilburn is not a reasonable person. He, by his own admission, takes everybody at their word, really regardless of the facts and circumstances, which is contrary to our jurisprudence under free speech offenses.
Didn't one of the other people who heard it or heard of it also reported to law enforcement, the daughter of some of the people there. I thought I had read that somewhere, and then I couldn't find it when I went back to look.
Your Honor, the record is not clear on how this threat was reported. It's not clear on who was on the back porch and who. Mr. Kilborn, he says he felt so strongly that this was an actual threat that he doesn't report the police that night. He tells his wife and leaves it up to her whether or not she's going to report it. That doesn't make any sense if you truly believe that that a special striker was a danger to President Obama.
Okay. Counsel, I see your time has expired.
Yes, Your Honor.
You'll have time on rebuttal. We'll now hear from the amicus in support of the appellant.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Arden Shilgar, and I'm arguing on behalf of appellant Robert S. Amicus. There's no question that the comments Robert made were offensive. The stead issue in this case was Rapert's comments. Rapert's criminal conviction, rather, under Article 134, is legally insufficient after the law is versus the United States or under the First Amendment. It is our belief that the conviction is legally insufficient for both reasons. First, after Alanis, it is clear that this court's current objective and intent undermines the most universal principle of criminal justice, that wrongdoing must be conscious to be criminal. Second, Rapert was prosecuted for expressing his political thoughts, albeit in very crude form. But in light of Watts versus the United States, when the Supreme Court found a threat against the president's life to be protected speech, it is clear that Rapert's comments are also constitutionally protected. For these reasons, Rapert's conviction should be overturned. In Alanis versus the United States, the Supreme Court left that statute very similar to Article 134, and in a 7-2 vote, held that a subjective intent test was the appropriate test for criminal threat offenses. But more importantly, I'd like to direct this court's attention to the reasoning in Alanis. The Supreme Court reasoned that a criminal defendant must be blameworthy in mind and aware of some wrongdoing before being criminally convicted.
So, counsel, why ask you the same question that I asked the counsel, which is why would, under the circumstances of this case, appellant's language is reckless?
Yes, Your
Honor. I mean, you agree that recklessness is conscious.
And under a reckless standard, we believe that it is that Rapert's comments would not be reckless, that they were solely negligent. And the most important facts in determining whether his conduct was reckless versus negligent is context. And context is everything in this case. So we know that Brian Rapert went outside after on the heels of the most anticipated political election of recent history, the 2012 election, was a strong conservative, was needed a place to bet, and so went out outside with his friends with a cigarette in hand and made these comments. He adamantly told investigators that these comments were joking and that he just needed a place to vent.
Do we look at this differently since Rapert was in the military and the individual to whom he made the threat was the commander-in-chief?
Your Honor, I don't believe so. I believe that under Watts versus the United States, we have a case that says under the First Amendment, there are circumstances where threats against the president's life are protected. In particular, they are protected when it's political hyperbole.
And the fact that he's in the military doesn't enter into that in your view? Because obviously the courts have held that there are different applications of the First Amendment when people are in the military as opposed to being in civilian life.
Yes, Your Honor. Undoubtedly, the First Amendment doesn't reach the military context and the civilian context coextensively. But we believe that neither does it take away all First Amendment rights from in the military context. And we have Watts versus the United States as a marker point for what that potentially means.
Do you think that Watts stands for the proposition that as long as the comments are made in a political context, no matter how threatening they might otherwise sound, they're not actually a true threat?
Yes and no, Your Honor. I believe to a certain extent it does say that. However, there are additional factors that Watts looked at that were important in its decision. And so not all political threats would be protected. In Watts v. United States, it was important for the court to see that the comments were conditional. And that is exactly what we have in this case. We present he might go home back to Missouri, put on KKK.
But you don't disagree that, I mean, I understand that you, that's one thing, way that you can read the record, but what he was convicted of is the language in the specification, and the language in the specification is not conditional.
He didn't say if, he said when I go back, I'm going to blah, blah, blah.
You might not have that specification in front of you, but I'm just saying that's it's the official record of what the person's actually convicted of that gets signed off on by the convening authority. So that's, I mean, that's they can accept language from it and change it, and they didn't. They being the members.
Yes, sir.
Counsel, the Supreme Court in Alana said absent, they didn't say mens rea always applies. They said as a matter of statutory construction, you need a clear indication from Congress that it doesn't. Now, in this statutory structure, of course, you have a broad and vague statute, and under the military system, it's up to the president to fill it in and to prescribe the elements of the offense. The president's done so, and he's done so in a way different from Alana's. Why isn't that enough?
Yes, Your Honor. And to that, I have two
Leaving aside the JSC thing, which, of course, number one is only a notice of proposed rulemaking, and number two isn't binding on us, not in its present. So why not?
Yes, Your Honor. And to that, I have two responses. The first, and maybe more importantly, it is the role of the judiciary, whether state, federal, or military, to check the legislative and executive powers when they infringe on the fundamental principles of life. And this fundamental principle of life was found in the laws. The wrong must be cautious to be criminal.
Well, but it's not a constitutional provision. It's not a constitutional decision. You're talking like it is.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. So, and this, tell me.
And this court has not previously shied away from adopting Supreme Court decisions that similarly uphold criminal justice standards. For example, in the United States v. Tempe, this court had Miranda v. Arizona and decided to adopt the Miranda rights. And there are also case law where this court has been receptive to adopting criminal evidence rules that the Supreme Court has talked about that also uphold fundamental principles of justice. And we believe that this case is no different. Under a subjective intent test, Rayford's comments do not suggest that he intended to harm the president. As I mentioned before, he adequately told investigators that he needed a place to vent and that he had a desire to harm the president. The record also indicates that Rayford never made or planned to make a trip to Missouri. And also the government uncovered no evidence that Rayford was involved in the KKK. Together, these facts suggest that Rayford's comments were part and parcel to the elaborate fabricated story of the war.
Well, he didn't plan to go to Missouri, but the president's coming where he wanted to go. He was in Hawaii. The president was on his way there. Does that make a difference?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't make a difference because we have, the record suggests that President Obama makes this Christmas trip to Hawaii every year. It just so happened that Rayford was going to be in Hawaii at that time. So, I don't believe so. If this board decides to stick with an objective intent test, Rayford's conviction is a closer call, but one that we feel does not support the intent finding as well. And here, context is appeal right. It's a key witness as a reasonable person. And if he thought the threat was serious, the intent must show you that it's satisfied. But this is wrong because Gilbert is not a reasonable person policy at all. On page 27 of the record, it indicates that Gilbert did not confront Ray about his comments and that he never reported the comments directly to law enforcement. Also, the record indicates that Mr. Gilbert's reason for taking Rayford's comments seriously is that he takes all threats seriously. But that can't be right. By that reasoning, all threats should be taken seriously. And maybe in certain contexts, we can argue that maybe some threats shouldn't be taken as seriously as others. In conclusion, under both an objective and subjective intent test, Rayford did not have the criminal intent to carry out this threat. I'd like to move on.
Is it the position of the anarchist that in Justice Alito's separate opinion, he says, I would hold that a defendant may be convicted under that statute if he consciously or she consciously disregards the risk that communication strings that will be interpreted as a true threat? Nothing in the court's non-committal opinion or its lower courts from using this reckless of a standard. Do you agree with that?
I see my time has run out.
You can respond to the question.
Yes, Your Honor. And Justice Alito's concurrence in Alanis mentions a reckless standard as being the standard for criminal court offenses under Section 875, the statute we talked about.
So if we found the recklessness standard here, it would be met here?
It would not, Your Honor.
Why not?
It would not be met because under the circumstances, context is everything. And we have Mr. Wafer coming out to the back porch, wanting to then, and telling investigators
in front of other military people.
Yes, Your Honor, in front of his friends, one of all of them happened to be a military person. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, is your and not putting words in your mouth, I'm just trying to make sure I understand, is your position that we can't quantify it as reckless because it was political hyperbole under the circumstances? The facts and circumstances where this is political hyperbole venting with his friends. So, therefore, it's not reckless, but if you use the same language in a different context, it could be.
Partly, Your Honor. Our argument is that it wouldn't reach the recklessness standard because he told us here that he was joking, as the record suggests. There was no indication that he was going to go back to Missouri to put out an order to kill the president. And the record and the government found no evidence that he was part of the KKK or his granddaddy was part of the KKK. And so it really doesn't, we believe, reach past the negligence.
Thank you. Government.
Chief Judge Irvin, judges of the court. May it please the court, my name is Catherine Yang Shea, and I, along with Major Stephen Collins, represent the government in this matter. This court has long upheld an objective test for proving communication of a threat from Article 134 UCMJ, and the Supreme Court decision in Alonis v. United States does not change that. Given the standard, appellant's speech here was not constitutionally protected, and his conviction was legally sufficient. Now, to prove communication of a threat under Article 134, the President has prescribed essentially four elements for the government to prove beyond reasonable doubt. The first of which is that the accused must communicate certain language expressing a present determination or intent to wrongfully injure someone, their person, property, or reputation. This can be characterized as the true threat requirement that the Supreme Court has espoused since laws of the United States await the Virginia versus Clark. Now, for this element, this court has held, and this president has provided, that the government must show one, that the accused knowingly communicated the threat, or the aim of communication, meaning that he made a statement in which he understood what he was saying and the context in which he was stating. stating it. Secondly.
Counselor, you could go through the statutory elements, but we have them, all of us, in our book, and other than the additional element of the terminal element, it's really not that different than the statute that the Supreme Court looked at in Alanis. And the terminal element doesn't provide any sort of a mens rea, either recklessness or intent, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So explain to us why, if the first three elements are very similar to the elements looked at in the federal statute, we don't have to consider what the Supreme Court said about the need to have something more than negligence.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, there are two additional elements. One is the wrongfulness of communication, which the government must prove. Now, this wrongfulness is a bit of a broad concept. However, it means generally the lack of a justification or defense. And this court has actually interpreted wrongfulness to mean for this particular offense that when there is proof of the accused's intent, he was joking, he didn't mean it, he was expressing it out of anger, all these things that we look at within the circumstances and context around that communication may actually belie or contradict that true threat being expressed in that expression. In addition to that, you do have the terminal element. And this is, in fact, another way to separate wrongfulness from innocent conduct, which was the primary concern of Willis versus United States.
So that, can we just instead say, well, then wrongfulness needs to mean that there's more than negligence?
I think that's one fair way to read it, Your Honor, but the way that this court has determined, the way that the president has required the
government. The president's explanation is the president's explanation. If the Supreme Court says that something more is required, right, for a similar type of statute, then something more is required.
Well, to be precise, Your Honor, Alonis versus United States, the Supreme Court actually stated, again, absent clear congressional intent. So again, we're looking at the statute, and Article 134 is rather.
There wasn't any clear congressional intent not have something more than any more than the statute that the Supreme Court looked at in Alanis, right? I mean,
Your Honor, actually, Article 134. If you look at the history of that statute, there are actually several enumerated offenses under which there is a negligence standard to several of those critical elements. There's a reason for this. And if you look at the underlying concern in Alonis, where they say wrongdoing must be conscious and be criminal, that comes from Morissette versus United States, where the Supreme Court wrestled with kind of, again, this movement towards the model penal code. But we have crimes that are not only trying to prohibit patently criminal conduct, so common law sort of crimes, but criminalization of conduct for a greater purpose. Article 134 fits those sort of crimes, where here it is about ensuring the good order and discipline of the armed forces or its reputation.
Well, now are you saying the terminal element does impart a mens rea? What are you saying? Are you saying that the terminal element simply sweeps more in?
What I'm saying, Your Honor, is these additional elements is what helps separate or keep the government from criminalizing innocent conduct here. That was the underlying principle in Alonis versus United States. It does not necessarily prescribe more than a negligence requirement to each of those elements. But again, this court hasn't, to be fair, understood this as a negligence standard. We've called it an objective standard. There are certain elements that the government must prove, and here it is that a reasonable person would perceive this as a threat.
Well, but that's not the question. The question is not the elements as they stand. The question is the effect of Alanis on them.
Yes, Your Honor, and the government's position is that Alonis does not reach this particular statute for the reasons that we've stated.
Well, you've listed the elements, but you haven't really told us why Alonis doesn't reach them.
The reason, Your Honor, is that, again, Alonis is based off of a principle which is not implicated as significantly with this particular statute, because there are, again, additional elements that the government must prove that would preclude it from actually capturing innocent conduct. Again, that underlying concern in the Supreme Court decision.
What are those elements, the terminal element?
Your Honor, the elements, again, are the knowing communication. Yes, the wrongfulness of it, a terminal element, and then the fact that the reasonable person would have to perceive this as a serious threat.
The argument is that you have to look at actions in this instance. At the government's position, do we snapshot have to factor in whether investigation?
Well, Your Honor, the analysis is it's what's been called the subtle analysis of all the circumstances here. So we have to look, you start with the words, they're a starting point, but context is what gives meaning to those words. And so not only are you looking at any evidence as to what he might be thinking, his claims of joking, what other people were thinking, their reactions, and all the circumstances surrounding the context in which that statement was made. And the government agrees that this is a difficult case and that these words, if expressed in perhaps a different context, would give rise to a different result. But in this particular case, when you look at the fact that appellant was making what were racist and violent statements that amounted to a threat against his commander-in-chief on a military installation in a military community amongst service members and their family members, and that he created enough alarm for this to result in an investigation in which even the Secret Service took seriously. I mean, all those factors.
He created alarm. So is that a heckler's veto?
Sorry, Your Honor, can you repeat
that? Is that a heckler's veto under the First Amendment?
I'm not sure what you mean by that, Your Honor.
That the permissibility of speech depends upon the reactions of the audience?
It is one factor to consider, as the Supreme Court espoused in Watts v.
United States. The Supreme Court has edged around that. You know,
they
don't like that.
Yes, Your Honor.
First Amendment jurisprudence. So is that what you're saying?
No, Your Honor. Again, these cases are very highly fact-specific analyses.
Distinguish this case from Watts other than
Absolutely, Your Honor. In Watts, you had a civilian who was at a political rally, so the context here matters. You have him at an anti-Vietnam War rally in which they were protesting being drafted, and he stated, if they put a rifle in my hands, the first person I'm going to put in my sights is LBJ. President Johnson at the time. And the crowd laughed. There happened to be an investigator in the midst, and this is how he eventually became convicted and went up to the Supreme Court. This is a very different set of circumstances here. Again, you have, one, a service member. And we hold service members to a higher standard as far as what sort of political speech they are allowed to engage in and what context they're allowed to engage in political speech. Most service members
understand that we're going to hold them to.
No, Your Honor. Absolutely. So as far as a true threat goes, Your Honor, this one, there was no contingent language here. Again, the contingent language that appellant now asserts came from a paraphrasing by Mr. Kilburn at trial. He admitted, actually, to both CID and the Secret Service that he made these express statements without the conditions. When you look at the context, again, this was, you look at the fact that the audience was people he knew through work, social contacts he knew in a military context, there's no evidence in the record that they were, you know, familiar with or normalized to these sort of conversations. So if appellant was, let's say, for some reason, a KKK sympathist group, or let's say it was like the Wilcox case where he's speaking to people he thinks are like-minded, that might provide a factor that weighs in his favor. But in this case, it was an audience that clearly had not been exposed to this sort of language before, and so a reasonable person in those circumstances could take that as a true threat.
Why don't we also take into context with these friends that they've been watching the election together and they acted inappropriately using...
Well, that record doesn't show that, Your Honor, not in this case. The record shows that, in fact, his audience, those that he were around were quite shocked to hear what he had said. Now, keeping this objective standard is well within the intent of the statute and the enumerated offense. You look, the purpose behind Article 134, again, is this compelling government interest in controlling this sort of speech.
The proper line is between political hyperbole.
The Supreme Court has drawn a line between threats against the policies of the president or the position of the president and the threats against his person. And so here, this amounted to a threat against the life of the president. And as the Supreme Court and this court has recognized, the government and the nation has a very strong interest in protecting the president from these sort of threats. When he says, I'm going to go back to Missouri, don my KKK robe, rally the troops, storm Washington, give him a good old-fashioned lynching, hang him from a tree.
Not in the specification.
Yes, Your Honor. It was not in specification, but it was in the record. He was convicted of, in the specification, he was convicted of language to that extent, but the record clearly shows that he admitted to the investigation.
I wish he was convicted of that.
Yes, Your Honor. It is the threat on the life of the president, to kill the president, Your Honor. The language at the very end.
I will ask for this one order to be carried out.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, he's describing a very realistic way in which, frankly, people have been killed. I mean, he was espousing connection to a well-known, historically known hate group, terrorist group in the United States, known to carry out these very violent, brutal ways of intimidation and killings. Yes, Your Honor. And that is true, but the problem is the audience didn't know this at the time. So when you look at why true threats are criminalized, I mean, in Virginia versus Black, Supreme Court espoused a couple concerns here. There is a harm that occurs when that threat is expressed. It's not just about the possibility or the probability that actual harm will occur. It's about the fact that when that threat is expressed, there are those around who are put in fear as to the possibility of that violence occurring.
So it is a heckler's veto.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And Your Honor, I know you had asked previously about the recklessness standard with this particular case. Now, recklessness would largely be defined as if the appellant in this case was aware that there was a substantial risk that his words would be taken as a threat and that he intentionally disregarded it. That has not been the standard that has been required by this court or by the precedent. But even if that were the standard here, the government would posit that this case certainly meets that. This is a service member who certainly was aware, based off the fact that he was with his military experience being in the military, that these were not comments that were to be made, especially in this context. He's aware that there was a risk that these would be taken as a threat, and he recklessly disregarded it. Also, to answer a question you had earlier for appellant Chief Judge Erman, was other people who had heard the statement. Ms. Abigail Whaler-Vines, the child of Specialist and Mrs. Fruge, heard it. That comes from Joint Appendix 44. Came from the testimony of both the CID agent as well as the child herself.
Did she report it?
She did. She was the one who actually initiated the investigation, because the comments arose from her interview, and then after further interview, there were more corroborative statements to that effect. Pending further questions, the court should affirm the findings and sentence in this case.
I do have one more question. What's the government's position on how the wrongfulness element provides any kind of a mens rea?
Well, this court has stated that wrongfulness implicates or speaks to mens rea where it is otherwise absent in the elements. And it's a rather broad concept, but I think it's been a tool that this court has used and that Article 134 offenses have employed in order to ensure that we don't capture innocent conduct. And again, I think this speaks to the heart of the Lonis decision, is that there's often a concern when it comes to writing criminal statutes of how to ensure that we are only prosecuting criminal conduct. And usually we do that with the mens rea requirement. But in particular, some cases, and the Supreme Court stated this itself, that there are certain crimes in which a negligent standard or standard where we use an objective test, where we prove just an objective fact that a reasonable person would have taken this to be a threat, to be enough.
So it's a substitute for mens rea, essentially, that argument.
Possibly, Your Honor. That's one way to view it. Again, it speaks, like I said, speaks to the underlying concern in the lawyers.
Rebuttal.
Your Honor, judges of the court, just a few points in rebuttal. First, under Chiarella, this court cannot affirm a conviction on a theory that was not presented to the panel. There was no evidence whatsoever presented by the government that Specialist Rapert ever intended to communicate threatening language. And so this court cannot affirm on that basis. Second, appellant wants to be clear that we're not saying that negligence could not be used as a standard under Article 134 of the UCMJ for communicating a threat. Our position is that what Alana says is that where a criminal statute is silent with respect to the mens rea on a material element, courts will not read in a negligence standard. Like the statute in Alana, Article 134 of the UCMJ does not require the speaker intend to communicate with the...
added into the elementation of the negligence. Explicitly said negligence.
Perhaps, Your Honor, Alanis does not speak to that question. It does not prevent the president from doing so. What the government is asking this court to do is to read the element of wrongful as negligence. Wrongful in the explanations of the MCM has not been defined as such, nor in the case law. Wrongful in the MCM currently is defined almost in the negative as something that's not a joke or something that is said with a legitimate authorization or purpose. Wrongfulness has never been interpreted to require that the speaker intend to communicate a threat, to communicate threatening language. And again, that is the primary concern that the court in Alanis had. Pending any further questions from the court.
That concludes the argument in this case. And in a moment, the clerk will adjourn the court. And at that point, we will be in an informal session. And we will entertain questions from the audience with the obvious caveat that there can be no questions about this case or any of the issues that were raised in this case. And I'll make a few more comments when we do that. Bill?
All rise.